Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Alessa Bali, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or on our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is The 9/11 Terrorist Attack, Legal Liability and Public Policy Issues. Today's guest is Stephen Badger. He is a 1986 U of U graduate who served as a leader of the plaintiff's executive committee responsible for the coordination and pursuit of all wrongful death and business loss litigation against airlines and aviation security companies alleged to be responsible for the attack. For 8 years, Badger's professional life was devoted entirely to the pursuit of this historic piece of litigation. During this time, Badger gained a deep knowledge into the events leading up to 9/11, legal responsibility for the attack, and the public policy issues presented by this unprecedented event. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you. That sounds pretty impressive. I'm impressed myself. So this is my homecoming week, in fact, very much so. I was a student here, as you heard, from actually it was 82 through 88. I hung around a little bit because I was having so much fun in college. So I joked with my kids and said college was the best 6 years of my life. And it was. I very much enjoyed my time at the U. But I've not been back here on campus in a classroom for 25 years. And it's really amazing that things haven't changed here much in this building since I was here 25 years ago. And I'm looking forward to going to my first U football game this weekend since I left here in 1987. So thank you. I did have the privilege to work on really what was my career case, involving one of the most historic events in our history, and certainly the most historic event that you will most likely have been aware of and part of in growing up. And today, just over 12 years after this event, I think all of you will remember it well. What were most of you, 9, 10, 11 years old at that point? Do you remember where you were on the morning of 9/11? Yeah, it's one of those events, isn't it? So these photos that we've all seen 1,000 times, and I still get a chill every time I look at them a decade later. You know, that morning and for the next few weeks as I watched this, I really had no idea the eventual impact it would have on my life. Interestingly, I had never been to Manhattan in my life prior to this litigation. I'd flown into the airports and gone elsewhere in New York. I've traveled all around the country doing litigation, but I'd never spent any time in New York City. What I do is called catastrophe litigation. It's a great word that I can tell people at meeting with friends, but really the legal word is subrogation. And what that means is when something bad happens, when something blows up, burns down, or falls down, an insurance company pays for it, all right? So let's use one of your house as an example. If a guy comes in to install a new air conditioning unit or a heater in your house, he's using a torch and he burns your house down. What happens then is you submit a claim to your homeowner's insurance company, State Farm or whoever then will pay money to fix your house. Now what happens under the law is State Farm then has a right to sue whoever's responsible for that event. And that's what subrogation is. And that's what I do. So I do a lot of building collapses under the weight of snow or rain, and a lot of fires and explosions, and I travel around when there's hurricane damage. We sue contractors who didn't build very strong buildings, all things of that nature. So we make demand on the responsible party. He turns it over to the liability insurance company because all businesses have insurance for when they mess up. And then what happens thereafter is that that insurance company then reimburses my client. They settle the lawsuit that we brought against them. And basically what we do is we exchange money amongst insurance companies. But in the meantime, a little bit bleeds off on the lawyers, and that's how the process works. So we'll talk about that a little more at the end. So does that make sense, that process? Okay. Well, in October 2001, I had a docket of typical cases, fires and explosions and things, but a client of ours called and said, hey, are there any subrogation opportunities arising from their claim payments for 9/11? This client, a large European insurer, just happened to insure the World Trade Center, a number of tenants in the World Trade Center, and a number of businesses and buildings around the World Trade Center. And all these claims were submitted to them, and they paid $2.6 billion. That obviously got my interest because most of our claims are several million, or a big claim might be $100 million. But obviously, we'd never had an opportunity to pursue a subrogation action for $2.6 billion. So the first question is, we treated this case like any other. Well, who might be responsible for this, right? Who might have been responsible for the 9/11 terrorist attack? Who would have legal responsibility under the law? Anyone got a guess for me? Obviously, the airlines, right? We'll get to that. But who else? Who else might be responsible for 9/11? The events leading up to it and allowing it to happen. The government, of course, right? The United States government. There's a lot of discussion about intelligence failures. For years, we talked about intelligence failures and the problems with the FBI and the CIA, the failure to communicate, and the events that allowed 9/11 to take place. So obviously the government is a target. But what's the problem with suing the government? They have what's called sovereign immunity. Right? You can't sue the government. And it's an old common law principle that when we developed our law here that we took from England, it's basically the phrase, you can't sue the king. So claims against the government are not allowed unless the government tells us we can sue them. Right? This is not an area where the government said we're allowed to sue them. So claims against the government were not allowed. Obviously, the terrorists might have responsibility, right? They're the ones who perpetrated the act, and also supporters of terrorism. So who might they be? The terrorists themselves, not a very attractive target for litigation. Al-Qaeda, charitable groups supporting terrorism, perhaps the banks who were holding terrorism funding and funneling money through to the terrorist groups. Iraq, immediately after 9/11, recall all the press and discussion about Iraq's responsibility. Perhaps they were behind this. In fact, it led to a war in large part. But eventually it was determined that Iraq was not behind the 9/11 terrorist attack. But there was a large contingent who believed that Saudi Arabia had ties in providing financing to the terrorist groups, which then in turn supported the terrorists that perpetrated the attack. And there was a large group of insurance companies who filed an action against Saudi Arabia. We didn't believe there was a legitimate claim there because our view was that the Saudi Arabian government could not be sued under the Sovereign Immunities Act. And it's a statute where the government has said, okay, American citizens can only sue countries that we are not friends with. All right, so you can sue. Remember Libya? There was a plane crash, Pan Am 103 years ago. All right, well, you could sue Libya because they were considered a bad guy. But Saudi Arabia is considered a good guy, and you can't sue our good guy friends. So our view was there were no claims allowed against Saudi Arabia. Some insurance companies and people believe they could get around that, but the U.S. Supreme Court, through a number of lower court decisions, in fact, affirmed a ruling that claims against Saudi Arabia were not allowed. Now, interestingly, that's still circling around. You may see some press in the next few months because there's a little sliver of hope that perhaps they can revive those claims. And it's back before the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. So if those claims get revived, you will see in the newspaper articles about court revives claims against Saudi Arabia for potential 9/11 liability. That will be huge news, and we're waiting for that to come out. I don't think it'll happen, but perhaps. Obviously, the last target were the airlines, United and American Airlines. Well, their planes were flown into our buildings, right? That's a start. Okay, that's not supposed to happen. They were responsible for the security checkpoints that we'll talk about. They have significant insurance, so they were a good target for litigation, perhaps, if they had responsibility. But we were being told right after 9/11 that, hey, the terrorists used weapons that were allowed through the checkpoints, so they didn't do anything wrong at the checkpoints. The government kept telling us that no one could have predicted this type of attack, and their liabilities impacted by the ATSSSA. What is that? That is the Air Transportation Safety and System Stabilization Act. It was enacted by Congress right after 9/11. Major piece of litigation, which did a number of things. It gave financial assistance to the airlines for their 9/11-related losses. Remember, all airlines were shut down for a period of time, and then very few people were flying thereafter. It capped the liability of airlines for 9/11 claims at their insurance limit. It's a really interesting issue. There was a law that was created after 9/11 that said if you sue the airlines, they can only be responsible up to the limits of their insurance. But we knew that limit was $1.5 billion per airplane, which is a lot of money, isn't it? So that gave us hope that there might be a chance to recover. And they created the Victims Compensation Fund. Government payments to families of 2,977 of the victims of the attack. Total payments exceeding $7 billion. If you accepted payment, you would waive your right to sue the airlines. And 2,893 of the families went into the Victims Compensation Fund. And that's very important to our litigation. It's basically had 3,000 families of victims after 9/11. And they were all looking to find out who's responsible for this. And they could hire lawyers, as they all did, and then try to identify potential defendants and file claims. It's just wrongful death claims, survivor claims happen in this situation. So they wanted, a lot of them said, okay, we're going to go after the airlines. And the government knew that would happen. So that's why they created, one of the reasons they created the Victims Compensation Fund. So a guy named Ken Feinberg was brought in, and he met with every one of those families, and he determined an amount of money that that family should receive. Right? But the issue was, if you took money from the government in the Victims Compensation Fund, you waived your right to sue the airlines. Okay? So remember that point. Interesting public policy questions that arose out of the Victims Compensation Fund. Why provide financial assistance to the airlines and limit their liability? We're a free market economy. If something happens of this nature, should the government be in the business of bailing out private companies? Why is the government paying victims? And this is really a fascinating issue. We could talk for an hour about this. There was a recent article, if you're interested in this issue, in the Dallas Morning News. Take a look at it. But what about Americans who die in combat? Died in the Oklahoma City bombing, died in the 93 bombing, died in the recent massacre by a soldier with terrorist connections in Fort Hood. All right? Did any of those people receive significant compensation? No. So why 9/11? A really interesting issue. There's been a lot of discussion about that. And lastly, what is life worth? People of all different backgrounds died in 9/11. All right? So take this example. You're the master of the fund who is passing out the money to everyone. And families come in one by one, okay? And at 9 a.m., you have a guy come in, and he worked for Cantor Fitzgerald, which was a brokerage house. And this guy was a bond trader, making $3 million a year. He was 30 years old and had a wife and two kids. Okay, and you had to figure out how much money his wife and two kids should get under this victim's compensation fund. All right? And then your next appointment at 10:30 was with a gentleman who was the dishwasher at the Windows on the World restaurant on the top floor. All right, and he made $18,000 a year, and he had a wife and two kids. All right, how do you value how much the bond trader's family should receive in comparison to how much the dishwasher's family should receive? And that's one of the issues that Ken Feinberg, who administered the fund, that's what he did. And he did this for almost 3,000 families. Right or wrong, compensation, how much that person made and his income potential was a factor in evaluating how much a life is worth. Fascinating book, and it talks about all the issues that he dealt with. Recently, Feinberg was quoted as saying, if Congress had to do it all over again, had thought about it a little bit longer, they probably wouldn't have done it. I think even Feinberg has decided by this point that the government getting into the business of paying victims of attacks or significant events of this nature is not a good idea. So we looked at the case, and we decided to tell our client, hey, here's the situation we have. We have a little bit of information, but there is a potential liability case against the airlines. We had a defined class of plaintiffs because we knew that almost everyone went into the Victims Compensation Fund. Okay, so only 84 people said, I don't want the government's money. I want to sue the airlines directly. Because remember, if you took the government's money, you couldn't sue the airlines. So 84 people filed lawsuits directly against the airlines. And that was important to our clients because we did not want to be in a situation where we were perceived as greedy, bad insurance companies competing for a limited fund of money with families. So we knew with only 84 families, you could pay them significant amounts of money comparable to what people received in the fund and still have plenty of money through the insurance available to pursue claims. And we knew what was there with the insurance. We knew there'd be a political industry motivation to settle. All right, we knew that the airlines and the United States government would not want there to be a trial laying out all the intricacies of all the events leading up to 9/11. So we knew there'd be significant pressure to eventually settle this litigation, like all cases settle. For the most part, 96% of all lawsuits that are filed are resolved without a trial. And the only cases that ever go to trial, for the most part, sometimes you have high-profile cases, for the most part, are auto accidents, slip and falls. Big cases like this get resolved. And we thought that would be the case here. So we filed suit on September 10th, 2004, one day before the deadline. We filed suit on behalf of our client against the airlines and others that we'll talk about in a moment. The total claims that were pursued, dollar-wise, because our claims were all property damage claims. So my client, remember, insured the World Trade Center and businesses in and around it. The other plaintiffs up top there all also were insurers that insured businesses around the World Trade Center. So collectively, we had over $5 billion in paid claims. My client had, by a substantial amount, the largest claim in the litigation. You also had wrongful death cases, the 84 people I mentioned. And then you had the owner of the World Trade Center complex who filed a claim as well. And then you also had some businesses who were in the World Trade Center who had claims because their insurance was insufficient to cover all of their damages. So they brought claims as well. So collectively, our lawsuit was around $7 billion against the airlines. Well, let's talk about 9/11. We know on the morning of 9/11, 19 terrorists started off their day intent on changing our history. 19 is a strange number. Why 19 and not 20? Who remembers? You would think four flights, five terrorists per flight, but we only had 19. Shortly before 9/11, Zachariah Massawi, who was believed to be the 20th terrorist, was arrested. He was attending flight school in Arizona, and the flight school called the FBI and said, something ain't right about this guy. So the FBI came in and arrested him. So they learned a little bit, but he didn't talk. So they didn't have enough information from the arrest of Massawi to take action with respect to the attack. But he was believed to be the 20th hijacker. Massawi was tried, and some of the information we'll talk about today are things that we learned during the Massawi trial. So the flights that were involved, four flights, the two that we focused on, crashed into Towers 1 and 2, an American flight and a United flight. But we also recall there were two other flights, right? Another American flight that crashed into the Pentagon and another one that crashed into the field in Pennsylvania. There were also the four security companies that manned the security checkpoints on behalf of the airlines. Interestingly, it's not well known, but the events of the morning really began in Portland, Maine, where two of the hijackers, actually the night before 9/11, they drove from Boston to Portland. They got on a commuter flight in Portland and flew to Boston and then got on the flight 11 there in Boston. And it's believed they did that because they did not want to arouse suspicion with so many guys going through, of Arab descent, going through the checkpoint that morning. They thought if they were already through security, it would mitigate the possibility of getting caught. All four aircraft were Boeing aircraft. We actually included Boeing in our litigation because early on there was a belief that perhaps Boeing had responsibility. If you guys may not remember this, but when you were real young in the old days, the cockpit doors were those little flimsy doors just like the bathroom doors are now. So it was very easy to get through those doors. Now, Boeing aircraft were built that way. Other manufacturers, though, such as Airbus, had for decades, because of their hijacking experience in Europe, had intrusion-proof doors like we have now. So there was an argument that perhaps Boeing should have had intrusion-proof doors. And we can talk some point after if anyone has a question about what happened to that, but it wasn't a very good theory. and Boeing did not participate through to the end of the case. Well, we had the two flights. You can see where they took off and where the hijackings occurred when the route changed. There's the World Trade Center complex. Recall we had the two towers and a number of smaller buildings around that were destroyed. And there's Building 7 next to it, which we'll talk about in a moment. There's Building 7. Building 7 was not hit by a plane, as we know. But Building 7 did collapse later in the day. It is the only high-rise to collapse as a result of fire or some other cause in this country ever. So there was a separate piece of litigation that was consolidated with ours solely relating to issues with Building 7. And if you have an interest in why Building 7 collapsed as opposed to the conspiracy theorists that we'll talk about in a minute, jump online and there is a lot of discussion about what brought Building 7 down even though it wasn't actually hit by a plane. And the short answer is debris from the falling towers struck Building 7, ignited fires that could not be fought, which ultimately caused it to collapse. Well, in the morning of 9/11, the events began at the ticket counter in Portland, Maine. All right? So two terrorists came up to the ticket counter to check their bag and get their tickets, and they encountered this man, Michael Toohey, who was a U.S. Air ticket agent.
They had a tie and jacket on, right? And as I'm looking at them, you know, they're holding their IDs up, and I'm looking at them. It's not nice, but I said, geez, if this doesn't look like two Arab terrorists, I've never seen two Arab terrorists.
That was your thought, first reaction?
That was my thought as I'm looking at them. I'm looking at their licenses, and I'm looking at them. And that thought ran through my mind.
Where did that thought go?
I don't know.
So Michael Toohey encounters two terrorists. He doesn't know they're terrorists, but they look like terrorists. And he sees them that morning, and they come to his counter, the only time he's ever had that reaction in his life. All right? And he's sitting there, standing there in front of them. What do you think he did? Nothing. He gave them their boarding passes and said, hurry, you better get on your way. And turns out they were running so late, the two terrorists, that their bags did not get onto the connecting flight to Boston. So their bags were still there after 9/11. When they opened one of the bags, they found a pilot uniform. They found a description of the events and their final words as to what they were going to do that day. So a lot of information that perhaps had they been stopped, perhaps something would have happened. We call that a missed opportunity. There's a number of them that arose during the litigation. And the theme with these missed opportunities is that if somebody had been telling these people, we'll talk about this more in a minute, that we don't know what's up, but something's up. You better really pay attention that perhaps he would have acted. But they weren't getting that type of training or education on the weeks or months leading up to 9/11. Now, the issue Michael Toohey's going to say, and the airline said, is that, but wait a minute, in this country, we cannot profile. Profiling is a very bad word. So you cannot stop people simply because of their race, religion, etc. But what Michael Toohey will say is that I didn't stop them because they are Arab. I stopped them because they looked like terrorists, and they were behaving strange, and they had all the characteristics of tickets purchased with cash, etc. So really interesting issue whether we should be doing more to screen for people and not objects. But then we always bump up against the issue of profiling, which we will not do in this country. So another issue we could spend an hour on. So Michael Toohey had these thoughts. After 9/11, he went all over the press. He was getting interviewed by Oprah, and he was telling everybody his story. And then 5-6 years later, we called Michael Toohey in for a deposition because U.S. Air was also one of our defendants. So Michael Toohey showed up for a deposition, and we thought he'd say all the same things, and guess what happened? Well, Michael Toohey had spent 7 days with U.S. Air's lawyers leading up to the deposition. And when he got deposed, guess what his story was? And it was a lot different. He said, well, you know, it was Oprah, you know, it was CNN, and I'm not even sure I remember these guys. So very unfortunate. Security checkpoint. The case was all about the security checkpoint, all right, because there's nothing wrong with letting terrorists on your airplane, right? What's wrong is if you let prohibited items through the checkpoints. So this case was all about security checkpoints and establishing that prohibited items got through the checkpoints because of the negligent conduct of the airlines. Remember, back prior to 9/11, there was no TSA. We all know about the TSA now, right? There was no TSA. Prior to 9/11, the airlines were responsible for airport security, and that was the deal. The government said, you can have the honor of flying our citizens around our country, but you have to provide for an adequate security system. So the airlines, by law, were responsible for the security checkpoints. Well, the process back then isn't much different than it is now. The technology's better. The issue we had in the case was what proof existed as to the weapons used on board the aircraft, because we had to establish that the weapons that got through that shouldn't have gotten through were used in the attack, okay? And that's key. Does that make sense? All right, so we had to establish what happened on the aircraft. The first notification that anyone on the ground had that something was wrong came from Flight 11, and it came from a flight attendant named Becky Ong. Becky called the American Airlines Operations Center, and they had this call.
Number three in the back, the cockpit's not answering. Somebody's stabbed in business class, and I think there's mates that we can't breathe. I don't know. I think we're getting hijacked.
Which flight are you on?
Flight 12.
And what seat are you in? Ma'am, are you there?
Yeah.
What seat are you in?
Ma'am, what seat are you in? We just left Boston. We're up in the air. We're supposed to go to L.A., and the cockpit's not answering their phone.
Okay, but what seat are you sitting in? What's the number of your seat?
Okay, I'm in my jump seat right now.
Okay.
At 3R.
Okay, you're the flight attendant? I'm sorry, did you say you're the flight attendant?
Hello?
Yes, hello?
What is your name?
You're going to have to speak up. I can't hear
anyway,
you.
Anyway,
what is your name?
Okay, my name is Betty Ong. I'm number three on floor.
You could obviously understand the confusion as to what was going on, but what did Betty Ong tell us in that call? All right, that someone was stabbed, all right, that they had mace or pepper spray, they couldn't breathe. So we had some information there from her call as to what had happened. Actually, let me step back. That was at 8:18. Just a few minutes later, the actual first notification on the ground that something was going on was received. And some of you may have heard these, but they're worth listening to. So Muhammad Atta was flying the plane. This was 6 minutes later. So when Betty Ong made her transmission, they did not know really what was going on at that point. So at 8:24, Muhammad Atta tried to talk to the cabin, all the passengers, but he pressed the wrong button and he actually contacted flight control. And this is what he said.
Is that American 11 trying to call?
Buddy, we have some planes that stay quiet and we'll be okay. We're heading to the airport.
And who's trying to call me here? American 11, are you trying to call?
Nobody moves. Everything is okay. If you try to make any moves, you'll injure yourself and the airplane. Let's be quiet.
That's good. I see your references to the move.
You can see what Otto was obviously trying to accomplish in telling people we're going back to the airport. All right. And again, this one as well.
Nobody moves, please. We're going back to the airport. Don't try to make any stupid moves.
I've listened to this 500 times, and again, I get chills. It's pretty amazing, isn't it? Yeah. I've got to get this up. Unfortunately, I can't get this graphic in the PowerPoint. So, in any event, we had other information as well. We actually had the receipt for a knife that Muhammad Atta bought shortly before 9/11 in Switzerland. And there's his signature for a knife that he purchased We also have evidence that was obtained from the World Trade Center complex. As they sifted through the debris, they found these items. They found no mace container, Leatherman Wave, and box cutters. But wait a minute, how do we know that that came from the plane as opposed to the World Trade Center? We don't. But they do match up to the specific items that we have receipts for that the terrorists purchased, the same type of item, prior to 9/11. Were these items allowed through? No. Despite what we were told in the popular press right after 9/11, the terrorists used items that were allowed, absolutely not true. Each of the items used by the terrorists were not allowed through the checkpoints and should not have gotten through the checkpoints on 9/11, including box cutters, knives, weapons or dangerous objects, and mace and pepper spray. Now, the issue with knives is if it was less than 4 inches, it was okay, if the blade was, unless it's a menacing knife. And the definition of menacing included a serrated edge. Obviously, those had serrated edges, the actual pocket knives that were used, the small bladed knives, and there was no question those were considered menacing knives and should not have gotten through. In some locations, some of the airports, they had security cameras. In Portland, Maine, they had security cameras that only took still photographs. So we were not able to actually see them going through. We just saw still photographs, and we really couldn't see much of Muhammad Atta and the other terrorists there going through. Dulles Airport, though, which was not one of our airports we were concerned with for the towers, but some of our co-plaintiffs, because there were some victims who were in the litigation who opted out of the fund, who died either at the Pentagon or on one of the other two planes, they were in our litigation. So what happened at Washington Dulles was very important to them and also relevant to us because it demonstrated the state of airport security on 9/11. So I'll try to walk you through this. All right, so you'll see the X-ray machine here where the bags go through, right? Back there is the first magnetometer they walk through. If they ding that magnetometer, they had to go through secondary screening here, okay? If the alarm went off here, then they would have to have a full inspection. So first we had this woman come through with her dog. Then our terrorists are coming right behind there. Now you see that right there? That tells the operator where the metal was generally on the body, so they focus their efforts there. Now, the regulations are very clear that if someone triggers an alarm, they have to identify what happened, divest the person of the triggering item, okay, and send them back through until they get a clear alarm. Does that make sense? Okay, divest, rescan, and then go through again. All right, so we see our terrorists back there. Here comes one through the first magnetometer. Let's see what happens with him. All right, so he triggered the alarm. He divested. He gave the guy something, and he's going through again, the first one. And that's the first step. Let's see if we can solve it easily by taking something out of their pocket or taking a watch off or whatever. So he removed something. He went through again. And what happened there? All right, he triggered again. So he had to go through now secondary screening. Now they're focusing on the girl here. Because if you saw the red there, she triggered again. So they have to find her item before they let her go away. Let's see if they do that. Now, the second terrorist went through the primary screening. Now, there comes our terrorist. He makes it through, no problem. They let him go. Now, this guy, see the alarm there? All right, so they're required by regulation to identify where it is, divest. In order to do a proper hand wand of the entire body, it is a procedure that should take about a minute. So now they need to find the item, divest him of it, and send him through again. Did that happen? Nope. They just sent him on his way. And that was the state of airport security on 9/11, when security was handled by private contractors working for airlines. And the airlines tried to pay the private contractors as little as possible because it was a cost center for them. And that's what we got at the security checkpoint. So the theory against the airlines was simple. Negligence was a negligence case. Just like a car accident case or a slip and fall or anything else. If you sue somebody, you have to establish three things. That they had a duty to you. All right. Whatever happened was foreseeable. And that they breached the duty by failing to exercise the proper standard of care. Three components of almost all simple lawsuits in this country. Well, remember, we've already talked about the duty. The airports had a duty to protect us in providing aviation. But the issue in the case was, of course, they had a duty to people in the air, right, to their passengers. But did they have a duty to people on the ground? Right? For the entire history of the U.S. aviation system, whenever a plane crashed and killed people on the ground or caused property damage on the ground, the airline stepped forward and paid for that damage and compensated the victims. But in this case, because there were billions and billions of dollars at stake, the airlines raised the issue that they had no duty. So the court early in the case said, as a threshold issue, I believe there might be a duty. I'm going to allow the case to continue. But he never reached a final ruling on that issue. All right. So it is possible that a New York court could eventually have held that the airlines had no duty to people and property on the ground. Now, there is one very small case left of my litigation, and it's Cantor Fitzgerald, the brokerage house. They did not settle with us. Their case is still pending, and they're moving forward to a trial. So I might be wrong. There may be a trial of 9/11 liability. But this issue of whether the airlines had a duty to ground victims and companies such as Cantor may soon get tried, or at least considered. So you may see that in the press soon as well. Court holds airlines have no duty to victims on the ground. So watch for that. Foreseeability. Did the airlines know or should they have known that terrorists might hijack a plane and fly it into the building? In the old days, terrorism was all about putting bombs in suitcases, getting them onto the plane, not getting on the plane blowing up. Right? So the government told us after 9/11, nobody ever could have imagined. All right? This was a huge part of the case. Nobody could have ever imagined that terrorists would hijack a plane with the intent of being suicide bombers, flying the plane into a building, and dying themselves. That was unheard of. That just couldn't have happened, is what our government told us after 9/11. And the airlines made that argument as well. Because remember, foreseeability is something we had to prove, that the airlines could have foreseen this type of attack happening. Well, back in 1989, Brian Jenkins, who was one of our consultants, he's the guy who trains the government, all the congressmen, on terrorism. He goes there every year, and the new class comes in, he trains them. And back in 89, he actually called this the nightmare of government, something like this might happen. The 9/11 Commission report, which I encourage you, if you have any interest in these issues, to pull it out, and it's broken up pretty well by different topics. The 9/11 Commission really didn't get too much into these issues. For some reason, the airlines got a large part of free pass in the 9/11 Commission report. They're going to say that the purpose was not to assign blame, and that's true. That was not their mandate. Their mandate was to collect facts. At the time the 9/11 Commission report was issued, they really did not have the entire record in front of them, and in fact, we don't have the entire record still today. What I'm going to show you, some of these documents today, are just a few of the items that we were able to obtain through discovery through the government or through the airlines. Most of the record is still confidential, and I can't talk about it. Most of the things that were said in depositions, most of the documents that were produced are all confidential. In fact, a lot of the documents we got, we'd have to go down to a little room in the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York, look at them, and then we'd have to leave. We couldn't take them with us. We had to petition the government to release them. So unfortunately, most of the record still is confidential. But what's interesting is if you have a trial in the United States, our courts are open. So there is a much more restrictive standard to keep information confidential once you have trials. So if this ever does go to trial, there will be a much broader record of information of events leading up to 9/11. But there was information out there. There were reports prior to 9/11 that something's up. There's a guy named Bin Laden out there, and he's talking about an attack, and it could involve aircraft, and we're really getting concerned about something going on leading up in 2000 or 2001, And these were all reports that were being disseminated down through the FAA and many of them down to the airlines, because every day the airlines receive security updates to help them perform their responsibilities at the checkpoints. And the Massawi memo, talking about this guy who was arrested just a few weeks before 9/11, and they're advising the FAA of a potential threat to the security of aircraft because this guy, they think, was preparing to seize a 747. The 9/11 Commission concluded only that the system was blinking red. And as I mentioned earlier, that was one of our themes. The system was blinking red. There was no smoking gun that said, hey, something's going to happen on September 11, 2001. But there was enough information out there that if someone had been paying attention, if the airlines had been telling these people who were out there, we don't know what's up, something's up, you have to exercise the highest degree of alertness, which was the standard, then perhaps something would have happened to derail this. We also knew terrorists had an obsession with commercial aviation, and plans for an attack were underway. We also knew they had an obsession with the World Trade Center. They tried to blow it up in 1993. All right? Are you aware of that? I mean, I think most people aren't, that they actually tried once before and tried to blow up the World Trade Center with a bomb. And it's really interesting, the similarities between that and ours. And that case, actually, a piece of it actually went to trial. And the people who were sued in that one were the Port Authority of New York, who was responsible for security at the garage entrance. And the theory was that they allowed a bomb full of explosives through the security checkpoint down into the building. A bomb was detonated, and people died. Okay? Sounds very similar, doesn't it? All right, to our case. Interestingly, during the pendency of our case, this went to trial in New York. And while our case was pending, post 9/11 world, there was a trial, and the last question the jury had to answer was, state the percentage of fault you attribute to the Port Authority, who manned the checkpoint, and the bombers. And guess how a New York jury, after 9/11, allocated responsibility? Totaling 100%. And they have to total 100%. Two-thirds to the Port Authority, one-third to the terrorists, showing that a New York jury, post 9/11, said, hey, if you've got the responsibility to protect us, even when it's a terrorist act, you better do it right. Lots of history over the years of aircraft being used as flying bombs. Where do we begin with this? Right? Of course, back in 1940s, World War II with the kamikaze pilots. Only a few of you in the room will remember this old movie. All right? Most of you guys have never seen this, right? There was a deranged individual who was flying a blimp into the Super Bowl, intent on causing damage there. But again, using an aircraft to strike a building. Black Sunday, 1977. But one that most of you will recognize. Remember this movie in 1996? Pre-9/11, okay? Islamic terrorists hijack an airplane.
I am free and in flight. The Americans wish me to tell you they have agreed to all of your demands. You are victorious. Come home.
I rejoice in your freedom, Abu Yafa. Allah has blessed us. A great destiny awaits us both. In a few hours, you will see I have achieved a glorious victory on your behalf.
All the people of Islam will embrace
you as
your chosen leader.
I am
your flame.
Pre-9/11 movie.
And with it, I will strike deep into the heart of the infidel.
And what he was going to do was crash land the plane into a building in New York City. Okay? So remember why this is relevant. Could we have imagined, could we have foreseen the possibility of this type of attack? Certainly Hollywood was thinking about it, right? For you conspiracy theorists out there, this was a show that aired. It was a pilot for a new series, aired in early 2001, just a few months before the 9/11 attack.
Depends on who your terrorists are.
The men who conceived of it in the first place. You're saying our government plans to commit a terrorist act against a domestic airline?
There you go. Indicting the entire government as usual. It's a faction. A small faction.
For what possible gain?
The Cold War's over, John. But with no clear enemy to stockpile against, the arms market's flat. But bring down a fully loaded 727 into the middle of New York City, and you'll find a dozen tinpot dictators all over the world just clamoring to take responsibility. And begging to be smart bombed.
I can't believe it. This is about increasing arms sales.
Pre-9/11 television show. All right. And guess what building they were going to fly the airplane into in that show? The World Trade Center.
We've got manual override.
Computers had taken over the plane. The pilots at the last moment were able to get control. And they saved the plane. Manual override getting it. Pre-9/11, the lone gunman. Now, those of you who are conspiracy theorists, I watched this recently with a friend, made me sit through it, and it's interesting. What you saw about increasing arms sales is exactly the theme of this movie that you can go home tonight and watch on YouTube, Loose Change, Final Cut. It's we found nothing supporting any indication of conspiracy theories. I looked through all the records from the 9/11 Commission. I was all over. You know, you learn a lot of weird stuff when you're talking about 9/11 all the time. You know, people said, hey, have you seen how they fooled the new $20 bill? That's how the terrorists knew which buildings to attack, because if you fold it one way, it's the World Trade Center burning. Fold it another way, it's the Pentagon burning. All right? But there's certainly no truth to any of that. But here's something really creepy that I know you're all going to leave here and go back and get on YouTube and show your friends tonight. Have any of you seen some little show called The Family Guy? All right? All right. This was an episode in 2000, pre-9/11, called The Road to Rhode Island.
Sorry, little man, everything gets x-rayed.
Wait, there's really no need to... On the good ship, Lollipop, it's a sweet trip to the candy shop where bonbons play on the sunny beach of Peppermint Bay. Let's hope Osama bin Laden doesn't know show tunes.
God, I hope I get it. I hope I get it. How many people does he need? How many boys? How many girls?
Isn't that really eerie? There's a pre-9/11 Family Guy about Osama bin Laden sneaking weapons through airport security. Right. And again, this is all not evidence we'd ever use at trial, but to demonstrate that the public was thinking about these things. And if the public was, certainly the government and the airlines knew that this type of attack was foreseeable. All right, it does get stranger. You guys all know that the kids went to James Woods Regional High School, right, because James Woods, an older actor, is the only person ever famous from Rhode Island. Okay? Check this out.
In interviews. In August 2001, actor James Woods was on a flight from Boston to Los Angeles when he observed some Middle Eastern passengers acting strangely. He told authorities what he saw, and the FBI has apparently corroborated that it may have been a dry run for the 9/11 hijackers.
I was on a flight. Without going into the details of what made me suspicious of these four men, although it would have been blatantly obvious to the most casual observer, I took it upon myself to go to the flight attendant and ask to speak to the pilot of the plane. The first officer came out. I reported to him that I felt that the four men, and I said, can you look over my shoulder and see who I'm talking about? And he said, yeah. I said, I think they're going to hijack this plane. I mean, everything they're doing, and I...
So James Woods actually believes he was on, and we took his deposition and talked even further about it, was on a dry run flight for Flight 11 where the terrorists were on and they were staking the aircraft and taking notes to see what would happen. He reported it to the pilot and nothing happened thereafter. Now, in fairness, the airlines dispute this and they say they can't find proof of the actual terrorist, the same terrorist being on a flight with James Woods. But James Woods is a smart guy and a very credible witness and he is insistent. And you pull up the whole video and watch the whole thing online. And it's a very credible story. But I don't know whether it's true. But anyway, it is a little creepy that there's another Family Guy 9/11 connection with James Woods, who the high school was named after, was on, believed to have been on a test run flight for 9/11. But the strangest part was, and I had heard rumblings about this but didn't know this, I spent 3 weeks sitting in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., and I encourage you at some point to go there. Pick a topic that you're interested in from our history, all right, and get online, and you can actually get a box of documents, the actual stuff from our history. You go into the National Archives, you go in this special room, you can't take anything in there, and anyone can do it, just get a little researcher license. You go in there, they hand you the box of historic records, and you get to look at them. Real stuff, military records or whatever. So the government released the first batch of 9/11 Commission records. So we went there and we got to actually look at the actual working papers, the notes, the post-its, everything. Some of it was pulled as classified. So I'm sitting there for weeks looking at things, and we marked things to be copied, and they would copy it on their special copier, special paper, and they'd check you before you leave to make sure you wouldn't leave with anything. And I came across this. Guess who overslept on 9/11, was supposed to have been on Flight 11, and missed the flight? Come on. No? Seth MacFarlane, the creator of The Family Guy. So I'd heard this, and I had no way this is true. But I'm looking at the National Archives at all the documents, and there it is. There's the list of people who were supposed to be on Flight 11 but didn't get on the plane. And guess whose name is on there? There he is. He apparently was up a little too late, had a little fun the night before, and said, I can't get up, and he called that morning and canceled. So that's why when you'll see a Seth MacFarlane movie or you'll hear him at the Academy Awards, whatever, he makes a lot of 9/11-related jokes. All right? Saw Ted. All right, he'll make a lot of 9/11-related jokes. It weighs on this guy. All right, he did a 9/11-related episode pre-9/11. There's some really strange connections. And he was supposed to be on Flight 11. So there you go. So if you remember anything today, there's an interesting connection with The Family Guy for you. So as always, I'm going over. Let me give you a couple final issues here. Breach. Now, the issue then was, did the airlines breach their duty? And there was no question, and you can tell already the theme, that the airlines didn't do a very good job. The government knew that. The government issued reports every few months, the General Accounting Office, which is a government watchdog group, and they issued reports saying airline security is a disaster. It's not good. It needs help. Lots of problems. So we knew leading up to 9/11 that we had significant problems with airport security. In fact, the security companies would hire employees from the Burger King at Boston Airport, because the Burger King paid them $5.45 an hour and they paid them $5.75. And that's where the people came from, in large part. A lot of new immigrants, limited command of the English language, who were manning the security checkpoints. And this is a news report just a few months before 9/11 in Boston, where the flights left.
Overall, screeners in both airports failed to detect 14 out of 15 items. We could have boarded any flight with a deadly weapon without getting caught.
As soon as we found out about this, we immediately went to the carriers, we immediately called in those security companies, and we immediately called in the FAA and said, look, this is a problem. You have to fix this right now.
We'd like to tell you now that security has improved, but even after we showed the security companies what we found, we tested a second time, and once again, at Terminal B, screeners did not open and search our luggage. I'm Deborah.
So that's what we had. We developed a negligence case. The case went on forever, significant litigation. We'd have depositions, and there'd be 60 lawyers in the room. It was real, lots of hearings in the federal. Everything was in federal court in New York. I was fortunate because I had the largest claim to be one of the leaders of the plaintiff's executive committee. In a case of this nature, a couple of lawyers are selected to handle the litigation on behalf of the entire group. So I worked with an incredible group of some of the best lawyers in the country who were on our team handling the case, and then also some of the best plaintiff's lawyers in the country. Who were representing the 84 victims in the litigation. At the end of the day, the case settled for $1.2 billion. The airlines agreed to pay us $1.2 billion to resolve our claims. Interestingly, there were some appeals from the World Trade Center people because they wanted our money, and I don't have time to get into that. But after a period of time, all of those were resolved, and eventually the proceeds were paid to us. Interesting issue for any of you who want to be a lawyer is that the cost of litigation is a significant problem in this country. You know, there was a $1.2 billion settlement. All right? That was the payment, the indemnity amount. But the transactional cost of what it cost during their litigation was significant. And that's a problem for the legal industry. What's the legacy of the case? You know, I'm not sure what the legacy of this litigation is going to be. If eventually all the information that I have that I can't talk about, all the depositions, all the documents, if all of that can get released into a public record somewhere, or in the future historians and researchers can look into it, then maybe there's a useful legacy of this litigation. If not, really at the end of the day, remember the first slide I showed you about insurance companies trading money in big disasters? That's what it is. It's a large swap of money amongst insurance companies. But one thing I hope that comes of this is that right now there's still discussion about, oh, the TA is terrible. TSA is terrible. We've got to get rid of the TSA and put screening back into the airline's responsibility. And in response to that, how quickly we forget, right, that they didn't do it right. And the TSA is a far better option than what we had before. But again, until we stop screening for objects, and we're taking off shoes, and we're dealing with 3-ounce bottles, but when we finally stop doing that and start doing what they do in Europe, is to screen for people, we're going to continue to have potential vulnerabilities. The World Trade Center has been rebuilt. I encourage you, if you go to New York, to go down there now to Ground Zero, the museum. The grounds are incredible, and it's a big part of your history. Hopefully you've learned a little bit today and have found it interesting. I appreciate you coming. I know I'm at the end of the hour, so if anyone wants to hang around after and ask questions, as you can tell, I'll talk about this stuff all day. Thank you very much.
Please join me in thanking Mr. Badger for this interesting and insightful forum.
Thank you.